Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Good evening. By pressing play, you've unlocked a door with the key of imagination. Beyond is another dimension, a dimension of sound, a dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. Welcome to Agoraphobia, the Agora Podcast Network's spooktacular month of ghoulishly engaging content, celebrating the spirit of the Halloween season. So turn on all the lights, check all the closets and cupboards, look under the beds, and continue, if you dare. Welcome back to the final thrilling conclusion of Agoraphobia 2019. Today's first segment comes from the Dark Lord of the Agora Podcast Network, Tom Daly, a sorcerer of dreadful power, master of shadows and of phantoms, foul in wisdom, cruel in strength, misshaping what he touches, twisting what he rules, whose domain is torment, and who's now come to regale you with a tale of loss, of fury, and of an ill-omened bird. Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, tapping at my chamber door. "Only this, and nothing more." Ah, distinctly I remember, it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I had sought to borrow from my books surcease of sorrow for the lost Lenore, for the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now, to still the beating of my heart, I stood repeating, "'Tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, this it is, and nothing more." Presently my soul grew stronger, hesitating then no longer. "Sir," said I, "or madam, truly your forgiveness I implore, but the fact is I was napping, and so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came tapping at my chamber door, that I scarce was sure I heard you." Here I opened wide the door. Darkness there, and nothing more. Deep into that darkness peering, long I stood there wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. But the silence was unbroken, and the stillness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was the whispered word, "Lenore." This I whispered, and an echo murmured back the word, "Lenore." merely this and nothing more. Back into the chamber turning, all my soul within me burning, soon again I heard a tapping somewhat louder than before. "Surely," said I, "surely that is someone at my window lattice. Let me see then what thereat is, and this mystery explore. Let my heart be still a moment, and this mystery explore. 'Tis the wind and nothing more." Open here I flung the shutter, when, with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped a stately raven of the saintly days of yore. Not the least obeisance made he, not a minute stopped or stayed he, but with mien of lord or lady, perched above my chamber door, perched upon a bust of Pallas just above my chamber door, perched and sat, and nothing more. Then this ebony bird beguiling my sad fancy into smiling, by the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore, "Though thy crest be shorn and shaven, thou," I said, "art sure no craven, ghastly grim, an ancient raven, wandering from the nightly shore. Tell me what thy lordly name is on the night's Plutonian shore." Quoth the raven,
"Nevermore."
Much I marveled this ungainly fowl to hear discourse so plainly, though its answer little meaning, little relevancy bore. For we cannot help agreeing that no living human being ever yet was blessed with seeing bird above his chamber door, bird or beast upon the sculptured bust above his chamber door, with such name as Nevermore. But the raven, sitting lonely, on the placid bust spoke only that one word, as if his soul in that one word he did outpour. Nothing farther than he uttered, not a feather than he fluttered, till I scarcely more than muttered, "Other friends have flown before. On the morrow he will leave me, as my hopes have flown before." Then the bird said,
"Nevermore."
Startled at the stillness broken by reply so aptly spoken, "Doubtless," said I, "what it utters is its only stock and store, caught from some unhappy master, whom unmerciful disaster followed fast and followed faster, till his songs one burden bore, till the dirges and his hope that melancholy burden bore of never, nevermore." But the raven still beguiling all my fancy into smiling, straight I wheeled a cushioned seat in front of bird and bust and door. Then, upon the velvet sinking, I betook myself to linking, fancy unto fancy, thinking, what this ominous bird of yore, what this grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt, and ominous bird of yore, meant in croaking nevermore. This I sat engaged in guessing, but no syllable expressing, to the fowl whose fiery eyes now burned into my bosom's core. This and more I sat divining, with my head at ease reclining, on the cushion's velvet lining that the lamplight gloated o'er, but whose velvet violet lining with lamplighting gloating over, she shall press, nevermore. Then methought the air grew denser, perfumed from an unseen censer, swung by seraphim whose footfalls tinkled on the tufted floor.
"Wretch," I cried, "that God hath lent thee, by these angels he has sent thee, respite, respite, and nepenthe from thy memories of Lenore. Quaff, oh quaff this kind nepenthe, and forget this lost Lenore." Quoth the raven,
"Nevermore."
"Prophet," said I, "thing of evil, prophet still if bird or devil, whether tempter sent or whether tempest tossed thee here ashore, desolate yet all undaunted, on this desert land enchanted, on this home of horror haunted, tell me truly, I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore." Quoth the raven,
"Nevermore."
"Prophet," said I, "thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, by that heaven that bends above us, by that God we both adore, tell this soul with sorrow laden, if within the distant Aden it shall clasp a sainted maiden whom the angels name Lenore, clasp a rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore." Quoth the raven,
"Nevermore."
Be that word our sign of parting, bird or fiend, I shrieked upstarting. Get thee back into the tempest and the night's Plutonian shore. Leave me no black plume as token of thy lie thy soul hath spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken. Quit the bust above my door. Take thy beak from out my heart. Take thy form from off my door. Quoth the raven.
Nevermore.
And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting, still is sitting, on the pallid bust of Pallas just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming, and the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
And now, to administer the last rites to this year's revelries, is the terrible twosome from the Cannonball, Deadly Daniel Doughty, and Professor Claude Myron Goozer, masters of the Aural Ludovico technique, who are ready to strap you down for an engaging ontological and epistemological discussion of Gothic literature.
Everybody, and welcome to an extra spooky vampy edition of the Cannonball, especially for Agora Podcast Network special Agoraphobia series, which we do every Halloween season. And I have to imagine that the folks who named the network had this particular joke name in mind when they named it such, because it fits perfectly, right? It's a great joke. But anyway, my name is Daniel Doughty. I am here with, as always, with my esteemed interlocutor, maven of all things literary, Dr. Claude Myron Goozer. We are typically the hosts of the Cannonball, but now we are going to do a special little episode. We're still going to rap with you about literature, about writing and culture, but it's Halloween time. It's a little bit spooky, and Claude, I have something I've been very curious about, and let me explain why. So for anyone who listens to the show, you probably know by now that I am a bit of an unreconstructed record store guy. I was one of those, back when there was such a thing as record stores, I just dated myself severely. But I would spend my meager Blockbuster paycheck at the CD store every week. I would talk to the guys. I'm heavy into music. I love it. Especially in the kind of, I guess what you might term the indie rock vein. It was the 90s when I first got into this stuff. And so anything looking back and sort of, you know, teasing out where that all came from, I love it. I dig into it. So one of my favorite things to do is to sort of go back, and YouTube has been a real godsend that there is such a massive treasure trove of old albums you could never find. People just uploaded live footage of bands and stuff. So it's a really fun way to sort of dig in and look into all those bands that you might have heard of once while talking to the record store guy who you knew thought he was too cool for you, but he still like gave you the time of day, I guess, to go back and sort of like, you know, educate yourself all over again. And one of my big blind spots in all this has been goth rock, sort of the goth genre of music. And I found myself sort of getting into it ass backwards because I've long been a big fan of the post-punk sort of aesthetic and era. That's a term that means a lot of things, but it was originally sort of was biographical. These were the bands of music that people who had come up in the punk explosion of this 1977-78 got into after they got tired of the whole punk thing. And so I've really gotten into a lot of like what you might call spooky post-punk. You're kind of that in the Joy Division vein, the kind that's all atmosphere and sort of jagged guitars and stuff. And I realized also that I was veering into goth rock. I was started getting, I mean, on the recommendations, I started getting Bauhaus recommendations. And I started getting curious. This is a long-winded way of saying, how in the world did a term which originally applied to Romanized Germanic military families come to be applied to a kind of music associated with teased up hair and zombie makeup and like, you know, white chalky makeup and sort of vamping around on stage? How are the links forged? How is the chain forged? And I realized I'm going to have to go to Claude, because being an expert in all things literary and cultural, he could tell me the answer. So Claude, what is the origin of the gothic aesthetic?
Okay. This is going to be a little bit convoluted because it's funny that you're coming to this sort of late in life. I came to it very, very early in life. I was there, not exactly at the beginning, but I guess as much of the beginning as you could be in a small southern town. Before the whole goth thing had really sort of reified into a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was sort of, I guess, proto-goth. I was definitely into the industrial stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of edge of metal, but Skinny Puppy was my favorite band. Always sort of drawn to the darker side. And I can't exactly trace the etymology of goth, or at least I can't do so right now. Give me another 6 weeks and I probably could.
Right.
But I can tell you a little bit about the background of how the literary terms developed, how they've developed over time, how they've shifted, how they've changed it, what they've signified, how they've changed it, no, how they've changed, what they've signified, sort of how they signified, and give you some examples of what the genre means. Now, this is really sort of a 101. Anyone looking for more depth, email us. I can tell you some other places to go. But for the sake of this agoraphobia episode, I think this really has to be sort of like the surface level stuff that we can bring to,
mm-hmm.
I guess, at least the 80s or the 90s, maybe even to now.
Yeah.
To think about the sort of darker aspects of literature, of cultural production, and how they manifest themselves and why they manifest themselves.
Yeah.
All right. So to sort of start off, we typically think of gothic and gothicism as the dark, spooky shit.
Right.
I'm being glib, and it's also late at night, and I'm tired. But that's kind of what it comes down to. We think of it as being atmospheric, darkly atmospheric, and in some ways connected to the supernatural. And that's kind of it. That has mm-hmm. something to do with the original source. But the Gothic, and I'm thinking here particularly of the Gothic novel, it really is an Enlightenment phenomenon. So the Gothic, for all of its spooky affect and uncanny weirdness, is really rooted in the Enlightenment, the presumed age of the rational, where empirical reasoning and a scientific worldview were rapidly dispensing with superstition. And an asterisk goes here because much recent thinking has worked to critique the underlying Western chauvinism and the claims for an Enlightenment epistemology, as well as the claims for universal objectivism. You know, we now, I think, are comfortably aware of the ways that the Enlightenment was a much more complicated phenomenon.
Yeah.
And how the epistemology of the Enlightenment was also an epistemology involved in the development of the tropes of racism and other certain kinds of shifts in superstition, let's call them that.
Yeah.
Right? But be that as it may, the sort of presumed Enlightenment rational worldview was one where reason and empirical observation would dispel beliefs in the supernatural or the superstition.
Right.
So early Gothic literature in English, and okay, I'm gonna delve into French at certain points here. Just skim the surface of it.
Yeah. Right?
But for the most part, we're talking about English literature here. So early Gothic literature in English actually espoused an Enlightenment ideology. So Horace Walpole's Castle of Otranto, published in 1764, really sort of exemplifies this. Castle of Otranto is pretty much Scooby-Doo. Right?
Yeah.
But with much more elegant syntax, and it lacks a talking dog. Okay.
So far, two strikes against it, but go on.
Right. So the story is a presumed translation of a medieval Italian text that tells the convoluted tale of an aristocrat divorcing his wife to marry the fiancé of his recently dead son, thereby forcing the fiancé to flee through a crumbling castle overrun with secret stairways and atmosphere and curses. That's pretty much it. There's lots of spooky doings, even a ghostly animated suit of armor. But at the end of the day, it wasn't an actual spook that was doing the spooking. It was just people doing horrible things because motivated by fear of a curse.
Uh-huh.
It's straight from the Scooby-Doo opening where there's that haunted armor walking around right. Glowing in the dark because somebody painted it with phosphorus.
And I think it's interesting that it's not even a matter of there's nothing supernatural happening, but everything is fully explicable, but it is motivated by fear of the supernatural.
That's it. And so there are a couple of important points here. First is the time of the tale. The 18th century English presumption is that this kind of story is more believable if it occurred in the Middle Ages, because that time would be much more likely to be quote-unquote superstitious.
Right.
Now, you and I have sort of been through this. I really think the turning point for us, please listen to our podcast, but the turning point for us was really sort of Don Quixote, where we delved into the background of what counts as medieval, what is and is right. not medieval, who is medieval, why is this so-called Middle Ages considered a dark backwards. It is from the viewpoint of the Renaissance, which wants to establish itself in opposition to that time period.
Right.
But, you know, to call the period from, let's say, roughly 1000 to 1400 as this kind of superstitious backwater ignores the complicated thinking and reasoning of that time period.
Yeah. We're really the... anyone just absorbing anything through just sort of osmosis absorbs that kind of Renaissance slash Enlightenment kind of, you know, how when you're like 8 or 9 years old and you make a really big deal out of hating Barney because you're over that baby stuff. That's exactly what that was.
it kind of is, because you just, it's in the air. It's assumed, it's an assumed point of view, and you assume everybody has it.
Yeah.
I think as we've explored, as many other actual thinkers and scholars, you're an actual thinker and scholar, I'm an idiot, have explored, The Middle Ages aren't exactly this like grim, dark, you know, time period.
No,
it's not without its horrors, as every time is. But okay, you get the idea,
right?
So the 18th century casting of these texts in the Middle Ages is on purpose. It's like, okay, that's a time period in which people actually believed in this stuff. So, okay, let's put it back there. But the place matters too, all right? So not only is the setting medieval, but it's also Italian, and therefore the predominant Christian denomination is Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
And Catholicism was Enlightenment shorthand for corrupt backwardsness.
Right.
Especially in England, where you have this sort of tradition of displacing your cultural anxieties on the southern Catholic nations. You can look at the 17th century revenge tragedies, which are going to come back into play as part of this phenomenon, and they're kind of proto-Gothic in their outlook. Allow me to digress.
Yeah, yeah.
The 17th century revenge tragedy, it always takes place in either Spain or Italy, because those are your Catholic countries, and we're talking about Elizabethan England, where Catholicism is outlawed. There's always some corrupt aristocrat who has done something horrible. There's a revenger who either goes insane or has to pretend to insanity in order to ingratiate himself into the aristocratic court. I don't know how insanity ingratiates you into the aristocratic court, but be that as it may.
It's an opportunity for noblesse oblige, I suppose.
Right, I suppose. So the revenger pretends crazy and then gets in there and slaughters everyone. So you get all kinds of lurid, creepy, grotesque sexuality, mm-hmm. as well as lurid, creepy, grotesque forms of violence. If you're looking for a great riff on the revenge tragedy, Pynchon's Crying of Lot 49 writes a revenge tragedy into the middle of it.
Yeah.
That is so over the top, it actually kind of gets it.
Yeah.
My favorite revenge tragedy is Ford's Tis Pity She's a Whore, just for the title alone. But it's a revenge tragedy, which, of course, it takes place in a Southern Catholic state. And at the beginning of the play, this young nobleman is obsessed over the potential for an incestuous relationship with his sister. He thinks he's found a loophole in canon law to allow it. At the end of the first act, he confronts her and says, "Hey, check this out. I think we can actually sleep together. Here's my reasoning." She says, "Cool," and they go into his bedroom. That's the end of the first act.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay, so that's, long story short, there's this long English tradition of kind of like othering the medieval Catholic states or the Renaissance Catholic states, but the Enlightenment really sort of took it forward with the Gothic novel. All right, so that's kind of what's going on with Castle of Otranto, and Radcliffe's 1794 novel, The Mysteries of Udolpho, works similarly. Mm-hmm. A heroine is set to inherit an estate in France, another Catholic country. She's taken to a gloomy, crumbling castle in Italy by a nefarious uncle, taken from France to Italy, and set upon with tons of creepy little contrivances to coerce her into giving up her estate. At the end of the day, it wasn't a ghost. It was her creepy uncle who just wanted the land.
Right.
Mysteries of Udolpho and Castle of Otranto, they have this reveal moment where, you know, they pull the rubber mask off.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Well, it's not a rubber mask. It's a knight's helmet and, you know, it's this other thing. But there's this reveal.
Right.
Okay. So, again, there's an emphasis on the supernatural happening elsewhere. And our shrewd heroine, Emily Saint-Aubert, is intelligent enough eventually to see through the spookiness and unmask the real villain at the end. And both of these Enlightenment or Enlightenment-adjacent novels really rely on the idea that the affect of superstition is a lot of fun,
mm-hmm.
but at the end of the day, reason needs to master the situation and illustrate that there's no actual supernatural influence, just some really bad people.
Yeah, yeah. I think what was pretty interesting about that description of the Udolpho one is that it almost sounds like the play Gaslight, from which we get the widely known term, where the whole point of that is that this, you know, a woman is well, it's this kind of, you know, it's not quite the same, but rather that there's, you know, mysterious goings on happening, and it's because of the malfeasance of a man trying to take advantage of a woman and break her mental state, basically.
Yeah, well, that was also sort of, well, kind of in a convoluted opposite way, Wilkie Collins' Woman in White.
Yeah.
Woman in White is about this, basically a long con to disinherit this woman and steal her estate. And there's this kind of detective figure who figures it out and thwarts this nefarious nihilistic Italian count. Hey, it's always Italian. you get the
apologies to any Italian listeners out there. We promise we are just conveying the sentiments of English people from a couple centuries
ago. Well, no, I mean, it really does seem like there's this long-standing English tradition of othering Italy. But yeah, anyway, so he sort of figures this out and thwarts this. It's like a Sherlock Holmes novel or a Sherlock Holmes story, except it's completely domesticated, or it's completely about the situation whose import really only matters to this one particular family. It's less about, you know, oh, these are matters of state secrets, which is how a lot of Holmes stuff kind of goes after a while.
Yeah.
Because Conan Doyle had to turn Holmes into this kind of national superhero in this way. But it's much more centered on just this particular horrible thing that's happening. It's sort of like Blue Velvet, right? When you think about
Blue Velvet, yeah.
What is Frank trying to do? He's basically kidnapped this woman's husband and son in order to force her into this coerced sexual situation, which is horrifying because, I mean, it's sort of like, this isn't about a large-scale plot to do X, Y, or Z. This is about just traumatizing someone.
Yeah, yeah, just tormenting somebody. Yeah.
It's sadism, you know, to a certain degree. Anyway, yeah. I digress.
Yeah, yeah. So the Gothic sort of has its origin in these Enlightenment ideas about the triumph of rationality, right? About the ripping away of the mask. But of course, that's also coming on the heels of the Romantic movement. And I think what most people would really associate the Gothic aesthetic with. So where's the turning point? Where does the shift happen?
Okay. In 1796, Lewis writes The Monk, or publishes The Monk. The Monk has all of those trappings, right? All of the old Gothic trappings. It's about this corrupt monk who sells his soul to Satan in medieval Spain, and there's all this horrible, you know, lurid nonsense that takes place, but he actually sells his soul. Lucifer appears at the end. It's this weird moment where the Enlightenment trappings are still sort of kind of there. That othering of Catholicism, that sort of like let's take all of our cultural anxieties and push them down south, is right there. But by the end, it kind of sort of is literalized.
Like, yeah,
they're talking about actual physical embodiments of evil. And when I say Lucifer makes an appearance at the end, he comes right in the middle of this auto da fe and sort of steals this guy's soul. All right, so you have this weird moment where it's sort of like the bridge between the sort of 18th century anti-superstitious stance, but the anti-superstitious trappings are used to illustrate this kind of superstitious story.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So things really sort of begin to shift in the 19th century, and writers in the period commonly called the Romantic Era felt that the Enlightenment thinkers had overemphasized an approach to existence based on the empirical. Okay?
Yeah.
So in short, they found the Enlightenment claims to an absolute rationality short-sighted and insufficient for accounting for the wild variety of human experiences. So if Candide's dictum at the end of Voltaire's novel, "Yes, but we must tend our garden," i.e. keep your head down, don't think too much, work and get paid,
mm-hmm.
is taken as a metonym for the Enlightenment view of the good life, then we can kind of see that it can't quite account for a whole other range of experiences that make us human, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of like the data-driven life, which reduces all to nothing but numbers. Okay, it can allow you to do certain things, but it doesn't account for all of our experiences. All right, so that sent the Romantics looking for other modes of experience or other modes of thinking. And here we find a reinvestment in exploring the supernatural and working the supernatural as supernatural into the landscape of Gothic literature.
Yeah.
And so an interest in the supernatural really abounds in Romantic literature, but it's typically not ghouls for the sake of ghouls. Rather, it serves to explore either a social, political, theological, or psychological topic. And the one I always love to turn to is Coleridge's Christabel. I think more people need to read this poem.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a poem that we actually brought up on the Cannonball before.
Yeah.
Christabel is the tale of a young woman in medieval England. It's England, not Spain or Italy.
Yeah, it's still displaced in time, but it's being brought back. I guess, you know, it was still Catholic back then, so it's still, you know, it's superstitious enough, I suppose.
Yeah, it's superstitious enough, but she wakes disturbed one night thinking of this nice young knight, right? So she's woken up in the middle of her sleep with what appears to be a kind of erotic reverie. So in her fluster, she runs out to the woods to pray, but who does she find but a young woman, Geraldine, who claims she just escaped from some abductors. Christabel takes her back to the castle, ignoring a bunch of eerie warnings that this woman isn't what she seems. The two undress and lay down naked together, and Christabel sees something in Geraldine that gets her even more flustered.
Mm-hmm.
Then the two sleep to wake the next morning with Christabel growing steadily weaker and Geraldine gaining strength. And so it's not a vampire story in Coleridge's hands, but that's only because the eerie supernatural stuff that Coleridge works with hasn't yet been codified into the recognizable vampire mythos yet.
Yeah, yeah, so like it's this kind of proto... It would be, I mean, I don't know, it would be anachronistic to even call it proto-vampirism, but this he's clearly tapping into the same kinds of threads that would later become, like you said, codified into the blood-sucking undead.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so weird how that happens. Okay, that really sort of happens with Sheridan Le Fanu, who blatantly rips off Christabel and turns it into his story, Carmilla. I mean, it's almost like a shot-for-shot remake of Christabel.
Yeah.
Carmilla is, except it adds in this one minor detail of the fangs and the scars in the neck and the actual blood drinking.
Oh, wow.
And then Bram Stoker takes Carmilla and just rips it off and turns it into Dracula. So if anything, the vampire genre is kind of a vampire in and of itself, and that it keeps stealing from the past to sort of resuscitate the past. It's the same imagined stuff over and over again, sort of recycled. But it doesn't have really that much to do with actual folklore on the ground. It's really sort of imaginatively invented by Coleridge. All right, so we have in Christabel a story of a young woman's arousal finding outlet in a way that Coleridge's culture clearly disapproves of.
Right.
Which ultimately drains the woman of her vital life essence. Coleridge is basically writing about a woman who is aroused, and yet the culture was so scared of women's arousal and what that would mean, and how that sort of thwarts patriarchal ambitions and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. It finds outlet in what to our eyes looks like a homoerotic relationship, which I think to our eyes is, yeah, okay, whatever.
And yeah, sure.
To the 19th, yeah, why not, right? And to the 19th century, that would have been threatening.
Yeah,
right? So Coleridge actually takes this and turns it into a meditation on evil.
Yeah.
All right. Coleridge's aim with the story was to provide a counterpoint to Milton's Paradise Lost, which attempted to justify the ways of God to man, i.e. to examine evil and explain why evil exists. And Christabel is ultimate. And one more time, I want to reiterate, not my terms,
mm-hmm.
Coleridge's terms. He clearly identifies homoeroticism with what he would have termed the unnatural or something evil.
Right, right.
I don't.
Some sort of uncanny otherness or whatever. Yeah.
But it's an unfinished work. Coleridge was sort of famous for writing these unfinished works. It breaks off at a certain point in part two, and there's an afterword where Coleridge suggests that the reason is because evil, or whatever was evil to his mind, is too enticing, right? Christabel's father's castle is still in mourning for her mother, who died long, long ago, and as a result, the castle and everyone in it exists in a kind of living death. And the only exciting thing is the succubus Geraldine. And the only thing really animating the poem is the homoeroticism mm-hmm. that for Coleridge represented evil. It's almost as if he had an inkling that maybe eroticism was potentially an animating feature of existence and not necessarily something to be shunned as dreadful.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like the... Harold Bloom actually wrote about this in one of his early books, like from the 50s or 60s, on romanticism, where you find in Christabel's father's castle, it's a living death. It's just this sort of exponential decay into this deadening nothingness, this deadening of the senses, this deadening of experience. It's just dead. And Geraldine is this kind of shocking of everything back to life with the erotic.
Yeah.
She's way much more interesting and way much more enticing than anything else in that castle. And how are you going to match that? Right?
Yeah.
You can't. And that's sort of where Coleridge had to turn away. All right. So be that as it may, Christabel really introduces a lot of the motifs of the vampire myth. And it illustrates this shift in the Romantic era of taking the supernatural seriously as subject matter, if only to explore other psychological dimensions.
Right.
And to sort of bring this home in a way that I think people are probably much, or listeners are probably much more familiar with. Probably two listeners out there, if that, have read Christabel. But everyone's read Little Red Riding Hood.
Oh, yeah.
The Brothers Grimm sort of was this attempt to go out and, I guess, cultivate this kind of folk wisdom and find in the supernatural or in these folk tales that deal with the uncanny or the sort of transmundane, as I think you put it once.
Yeah.
Some kind of truth that runs counter to the Enlightenment, to basic empirical understanding. But there's something else that I want to throw in there, is one of the things that you also have in this period, right, in the 19th century, typically later 19th century, is the rise of industrialization. Like, the Industrial Revolution has already kicked in England, and the shifts in printing actually make a lot more lurid material available to the public.
Yeah.
So you get the rise of the penny dreadful, and penny dreadfuls that's pretty much an apt name. They're really gross and grotesque, and
it's all spectacle, you know.
Yeah, but it's sort of like it's spectacle in the same way that like a Lifetime movie is spectacle. They trade in sort of cheap sentimentality, lurid grotesque details, and then cheap, I guess, moralization by the end.
Sure.
Right? But it's a sort of marker of, and they're often they're very exploitative, and they're often sort of cynically written. The king of them was Edgar Allan Poe. Poe wasn't necessarily the dark, grim, gruesome, oh, I'm the creepy outsider. That definitely was the look that he cultivated.
Yeah.
But a lot of the lurid stuff he wrote was sort of cheap sensationalism to get readership. It was clickbait.
Yeah, I guess honestly, what I was, you know, the way you've been explaining how the Gothic developed, you know, over the course of the Romantic period, I immediately thought of the fall of the House of Usher. Just as, which I guess, I don't know if that falls within the Gothic, you know, proper or whatever, but like it hits all these hallmarks we've been talking about, as well as kind of, I guess, playing it a little like, what's the word? Giving a light touch to the supernatural stuff, which is certainly there, and it's absolutely like the story doesn't make any sense unless we assume the supernatural is at work, but it is not sort of highlighted necessarily.
Well, the American Gothic is weird. I mean, we're digressing all over the place, so let's just jump into it. The American Gothic is weird, and the Southern Gothic is even weirder. Both tend to have this anxiety or express this kind of cultural anxiety about the persistence of the errors of the past into the present.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what Dracula does, and we'll get to Dracula in a second. But look at all of Nathaniel Hawthorne. Hawthorne is sort of obsessed by this national guilt, or I guess this regional guilt over, you know, the Puritan hypocrisy and the witch trials and Hawthorne's own family interaction with that. One of his ancestors was really one of the worst possible judges that you could have in the Salem witch trials. Just a horrible bastard of a human being. And Hawthorne wanted to take that on as this kind of original sin in the nation. Right? The national outlook in the 19th century, or the American national outlook in the 19th century, was this kind of cheerful can-do, basically sort of like that 1980s...
The whole morning in America malarkey.
Yeah, that's kind of it. Hawthorne wanted to explore this other kind of psychological darkness that was lurking back there that he thought was part and parcel with
all
this other stuff. It's the persistence of the past into the present. And then look at Edgar Allan Poe, and we can't forget that Poe was a Southern writer.
Yeah, he was in Baltimore. He was a Southerner.
Raised in Richmond.
Oh, wow, okay, yeah. Even, yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot in Poe where if you go looking for it, there's this weird kind of aristocratic or even master-slave relationship. And you find the persistence of weird aristocratic trappings into the present, and that persistence is damning. House of Usher is a perfect case where it's sort of like a mockery of aristocratic pretense. And what is America but a place where we threw off aristocracy only to establish aristocratic oligarchies in the South.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, there was. This is going to kill me that I cannot remember the name of it now. But I actually just recently read a book by a scholar on the topic of the survival of feudal labor relationships specifically, but feudal property and labor relationships into what we call little L liberalism in the United States of America. So I think that's astonishing to me that there was this. We have these connections in the literature of the time, and also, like, I just read this extremely dry but very well argued history book about it.
Well, then, okay, you can take it to the 20th century, and you've got someone like Faulkner who is trafficking in the persistence of the past into the present as horror. I mean, yeah, like yeah. Rose for Emily. I'm just touching on Rose for Emily because it's the easiest one to address in however long we've got for this. But Rose for Emily is all about this kind of vampiric ghost who won't go away.
A cannibalistic,
necrophiliac, possessing ghost who nobody can get rid of.
Yeah.
And the attitude of the place towards that ghost is complicated.
It's
all about the changes that are taking place that Emily Grierson will not allow for herself or for those around her. So in America, it's often got this kind of like political valence.
So I
wanted to bring up the Penny Dreadfuls because they're a marker of industrialization.
They're
cheap throwaways.
Right.
But I also wanted to bring them up because they're anticipated by this guy who I think more people should read him, De Quincey. He did this book called Confessions of an English Opium Eater.
I've heard of that. But I don't know much about it, but I've heard of it.
Yeah, Thomas De Quincey. He was kind of a one of those child prodigies. Poor kid went to this phenomenal boarding school. Was too smart for it. Either got kicked out or left. Basically, hitchhiked to London and then just squatted. And wrote these fantastic memoirs just about like. These weird situations that he would get in, but he, along with many others, got accidentally addicted to opium. There was a very similar phenomenon in the 19th century, like late 18th, early 19th century, very similar phenomenon to the opioid addiction today. Opium was being prescribed for everything as a kind of cure-all. And at one point, it was cheaper for him to, as far as I understand it, or as far as I believe the biographers think it goes, it was cheaper for him to get opium than to buy food. And that could, like, quell the stomach pains. And he got hooked. And he was this really fascinating thinker and fascinating writer. And he garnered this reputation. And he published his memoirs, and they're fascinating for his self-analysis.
Yeah.
Like, what he can do is analyze his own nightmares in this really fascinating, weird, creepy way. And he had a taste for the Gothic. He wrote this essay called The Knocking at the Gates of Macbeth, where he analyzes the porter scene as necessary for Macbeth because he says the comedy is there to exacerbate the horror.
You know what? I need to read this essay because I feel the same way. Because man, it just boy does the comedy fall flat to me in that scene.
Well, he says it's there to break up the horror because if you go from hideous thing to hideous thing, it's too much. But what it does is sort of like breaks in with this weird thing that's just morbid and strange. He did an essay called Murder Considered as One of the Fine Arts, where it's this imagined club of murderers talking about their, I guess, aesthetic murders. I mean, it completely anticipates Hannibal Lecter, right? Murder as aesthetics, which is kind of like taking aestheticism to its furthest end. And then, but he did this other thing, which I think is connected to how we might think of the rise of the Gothic and the rise of the lurid in the popular imagination. All right, so De Quincey, he was recognized as a fantastic writer, and he made friends with Coleridge and Wordsworth who saw in him, you know, something of a kindred spirit, but also, you know, this dude that they wanted to nurture and, you know, get him on his feet so that he could maybe kick the addiction a little bit and actually do some writing. So they took him up to the Lake Country and set him up with an easy job in the hopes that he would, you know, kick back, relax a little bit, wean himself off of opium, and not have to worry too much so that he could get his health back and become, you know, a brilliant genius writer. Okay, his easy job was running the local newspaper.
Yeah.
Okay? So it's just like whatever local rag. It was so boring, and he got so tired of it. And he had the hardest time kicking opium because it was so boring. Like, there was nothing to do in the Lake Country.
Yeah.
So he's out there sweating it out. He's bored out of his mind. He doesn't have anything to do. He has no interest whatsoever in writing about the sort of farmer's problems in the local rag. He's got pages to fill, and he has no connections up there, and he can't get any writers going. So what he does is starts basically just making clippings of the London crime sheets. Like, all the – just the police blotter. Like, making clippings of that and printing it in the back of this, you know, local rag. Subscriptions go through the roof. Everyone wants to read
the horrible, lurid horror tales. Yeah. Oh, man. So this is like he was the first true crime podcaster.
More or less. Yeah. And it was all because he didn't want to kick opium. There's this other thing that's sort of taking place in the late 18th, early 19th century, which is Orientalism. There's a text that I know of and don't really know, but it's Vatek, but written by William Beckford.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of this Orientalist tale about this sultan who has magic and goes off throughout the Middle East doing all kinds of weird gothic stuff. It's that basic othering.
Yeah. Right?
But it's kind of an extension of that. We'll take all of this magic stuff and displace it into another place and time, right? But in this case, it's displacing it into what are essentially the British colonies.
Yeah, yeah.
And Byron really exploits Orientalism as a sort of gothic trapping throughout his whole career. So you've got all of these different strands kind of coming into it in the 19th century, partially playing on that Enlightenment colonialist othering aspect, partially playing on this interest in the supernatural as what's going on in our backyard that is in opposition to the Enlightenment, or what is a kind of truth that is non-empirical. And these all get sort of woven together, and that's where you get something like Dracula.
I was gonna say, yeah, this all sounds, especially like the Orientalism and things like that's absolutely where Dracula's at, which is also this kind of this bridge from, we've already mentioned some of the 20th century Gothic, but I think Dracula bridges this 19th century to 20th century Gothic.
I don't mean to overlook Frankenstein. Frankenstein is one of the most important novels of that time period, and I would argue that it's one of the most important novels to come out of the English tradition.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah.
It's weird because the Shelleys weren't the anti-scientific couple that you might think of when you think romantic.
Yeah.
But Mary Shelley was definitely interested in really exploring the ways that the scientific discourse of her day and of the Enlightenment and of our own day. I mean, she sort of anticipates the critiques of the 20th and 21st century.
Yeah, yeah.
The way that scientific discourse is often sort of conceiving of itself as a mastery over time and space. Yeah. And she puts that completely in patriarchal terms. I mean, in Frankenstein, the way that Victor thinks about nature, it's always personified as feminine, and he wants to master the feminine and, in some really creepy language, intrude into nature and rip it apart and rip it open and see how it works. It's really grotesque.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's this anti-Enlightenment critique going all throughout Frankenstein. It's extraordinarily important. And the sort of psychological aspects of Frankenstein really anticipate a lot of that Victorian stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The most of Frankenstein isn't going through the charnel house and doing all that sort of stuff. It's the anxiety that this thing that you did, that you've tried to, I guess, cordon off,
yeah,
keeps coming back in some way, shape, or form.
It's, right,
it's closer to Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah, it's the dread. Yeah, it's that's absolutely it. Yeah, I mean, we can honestly, and we can save. We're probably going to need a dedicated episode to Frankenstein on down the line. And I just as an aside,
absolutely.
I think it is quite interesting that we're talking about the Gothic tradition, and two novels have come up that, in my reading on the science fiction genre, have been sort of pinpointed by the respective scholars as the origin of the science fiction tradition. Brian Aldiss places it at Frankenstein. Alexei Panshin places it at the Castle at Otranto. So this is very, this is kind of interesting to me as a science fiction genre head, that like clearly the sort of the kissing cousins relationship of these kinds of genres, you know, coming clear.
I mean, like in the 19th century, the thing that I guess I'm trying to point out here is that, okay, science fiction, horror, the detective novel, the sort of gothic romance, the penny dreadful, all of the orientalist tendencies, all of this is sort of mixed up together. I mean it's sort of like part and parcel with each other, and it doesn't sort of really get separated out until you move later on down the line.
Right, right.
When there's this kind of intense focus on classification and breaking it down into what is what and how what operates according to what. But it's all intertwined.
Yeah.
It's difficult to separate these strands. I mean, so much of the Sherlock Holmes stories and the early, you know, stories of detection are orientalist stories. Like, okay, and I want to make sure everybody understands how I'm using that. That's a literary term sort of developed most closely by Edward Said to look at the ways that Western cultures or European cultures, particularly colonizing cultures, look at the colonized as other in this exotic way.
Right.
And so much of the Sherlock Holmes stories or early detection stories are about something exotic out there coming back and causing either criminal mischief or supernatural mischief, mm-hmm, in the colonizing nation.
Mm-hmm.
It's all connected together.
That's right, and there's a lot of threads to pluck at. Which is this is one of those shows that we do where we realize like we have so much more to say about everything than listening to the topic.
Well,
but
okay.
Oh, sorry.
That brings us back. That brings us back to Dracula.
Which, yeah, okay, yeah.
The plot of Dracula is exactly the plot of Heart of Darkness.
Yeah.
Civilized, quote unquote, civilized white European goes out there. Something happens out there. He comes back and brings out there with him.
Back with him, right.
Threatens
right.
to destroy civilization. But Dracula is, as far as we're talking about the Gothic novel, it's weird because it breaks all the rules. If the Gothic began as an attempt to embrace reason and realism and dispel superstition, Dracula is the antithesis of that impulse.
Yeah, it's the complete inversion of this, the sort of the origin of the Gothic aesthetic.
Yeah, Dracula is all about how science and technology are no match for the dark supernal evil that lurks in the shadows of the European past to come back and plague the future. So much of Dracula is about the way science and progress fail when confronted with the quote-unquote hidden wisdom of folk culture. The heroes in the novel have access to all kinds of newfangled gizmos and gadgets. Mm-hmm. They're on the cutting edge of technology. Seward records his diary entries on wax cylinder. Quincy Morris uses the most up-to-date repeater rifles. So much of the transportation takes place by train, right? Which is archaic now, but that was cutting edge at the time.
Oh, yeah.
It's actually technology and political advancement that brings Dracula to London. Harker uses the trains to actually get to Transylvania, and the Count is only allowed to own land in London due to the relatively recent land reform acts of the Victorian age that allowed foreigners to own land in Britain.
From here to you describe that, I'm astonished that like the Dracula story has not become a big can art for the Brexit types.
Yeah,
like, can you believe we let Romanians into England? And look at that, they're draining our versions of blood.
Well, there's actually, oh shoot, the name of it is escaping me. There was a Catalan author
mm-hmm.
who did this vampire story about these Enlightenment, or these later sort of vampire hunters who have to hunt this vampire. Who is sort of representative of that kind of repressive fascist past. There's this way that the vampire keeps recurring as this thing that it's like what we were just talking about with Poe and Faulkner. It's the past that sort of returns to haunt you. But yeah, in Dracula, it's the past that returns to haunt you because the present has gotten too progressive. Yeah. So in the face of what we're meant to believe is pure evil, the heroes have to revert to folk superstition to thwart the vampire.
Right.
So, guided by Van Helsing, Holmwood, Seward, Morris, and Harker go so far as to brandish crosses as a form of defense. There's a subtle embrace of Catholicism within that gesture, as it suggests a return to the iconography of a pre-Protestant mode of belief.
Hmm. Yeah.
Right? So they have to go back to superstition. So, in effect, Dracula takes the Enlightenment ideals of the early Gothic and subverts them.
Yeah.
So it kind of comes full circle.
And that kind of sets the stage for the kind of the Gothic aesthetic as we know it. And I know we have to skip over a lot, but I was really interested in your biographical element about having been sort of there in the incipient Goth movement, because as we understand, like, the Goth aesthetic today is very much imbued with otherworldliness, with the supernatural, with spookiness in general. And so it's kind of, that kind of flipped on its head thing of, like, you know, Scooby-Doo is the least Goth thing imaginable, right? Because it's eliminating the uncanny. It's taking it away. So it's kind of fascinating. There was this reversal, but sort of what do you think led to that kind of the emergence of a Goth aesthetic in sort of American popular culture that you happen to be a part of?
Repetition. I'm not being glib here. By the 1890s, it was over and done with, or by the early 1900s, it was kind of over and done with. Mm-hmm. You find remnants of it in modernism, but Henry James has all these great short stories that are sort of Gothic aestheticist mysteries. If anybody's interested, the way I kind of began to intellectualize this was in undergrad. One of my undergrad professors was actually a scholar of the Gothic, and if you're interested at all, look up the dude, John Paul Riquelme, Riquelme, really fascinating dude who has this kind of like running large scale theory that aestheticism and the Gothic are kind of like two sides of the same coin.
Hmm.
By the time you get to the 19th century, because aestheticism represents this antisocial tendency in England, right? In the Victorian era, the whole impulse is towards curtailing the personal for the sake of the social.
Yeah.
And what is pleasure if not antisocial? So you get something like Dorian Gray, which is kind of like this weird quintessential gothic novel that is absolutely antisocial, but it's hard to call Dorian evil at certain points.
Sure, sure.
Okay, so anyway, Henry James, in between, Henry James wrote a bunch of complicated novels early on. They didn't sell. He was frustrated and annoyed and wrote these kind of bizarre stories, which are and are not like his later novels. Mm-hmm. But they're these weird gothic aestheticist mysteries, and already the gothic in James is kind of like a laughable stereotype. It's something that's sort of like what we would mock in the goth kids today, I guess, or sort of, you know, prey to. But it's sort of like, this is useless, this is silly, this is over affected.
Yeah.
Right. But you find remnants of the gothic in modernism. Eliot rips off The Brides of Dracula in The Wasteland. It's one whole section of it.
Yeah, yeah.
You find these sort of gothic tinges with the bats and vampirism all throughout James Joyce. It keeps pinging here and there and then sort of falls to the wayside. The way I think it sort of reemerged in the 80s was as the failure of the hippies.
Okay.
The failure of the counterculture. You know, the way the counterculture was sort of interpreted, or, well, it was anticipated and interpreted.
Yeah.
Look at something like Zabriskie Point, which interprets the counterculture as basically nihilistic, hedonistic, apocalyptic craziness.
Yeah. Right?
And then whatever the actual counterculture was, Manson became the poster boy for what it would be.
Yeah.
Right? The Manson murders basically sort of fulfilled the prophecy that the culture, like, they fulfilled the cultural anxiety.
Yeah, yeah. It was almost, not to get too conspiratorial, but it was almost too perfect as a mode to discredit the counterculture.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And so there's this way in which the gothic emerges as the trappings of that counterculture, but recognizing that it's doomed to failure. So instead of do your own thing, we're out there, it's sort of a counterculture that embraces the outsider status.
Yeah.
But that embrace of outsider status undoes whatever revolutionary gestures were there in the first place.
Yeah, like, it's not so much a matter of embracing the outsider status to overturn anything. It's embracing the outsider status to remain outside.
Yeah, which is where you get something like Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah.
Probably
the chintziest, most commercial appropriation of goth aesthetic, you're onto something. Take me there.
Okay, so, all right. Let me take you back to when I was three. I had a couple of favorite books that I would get from the library all the time. One was Mike Mulligan and a Steam Shovel, because that was just really cool.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Tractors and
the art's great.
I always loved tractors.
Yeah.
The other were all those orange-backed Universal Monster books. I don't know if you know those. Somebody who's listening knows those.
Oh, no. I know exactly what you mean. It was like, they had like orange and black covers, right?
Yeah, there were these orange covers. And
Oh my God, I loved those.
Those were kind of what I lived on.
Yeah.
I was a scared kid, and I was growing up in the satanic panic of the
90s
and the 90s, where, you know, kids were emerging on milk cartons, and everyone who you saw was going to abduct you and take you away and everything like that. And so I guess I just grew up anxious. But the I loved those monster things. I loved that. And it was sort of like the other two, you know, everyone telling me that everything was going to be okay at the same time as When I was 4 years old, my next door neighbor told me about how we were all going to die in a nuclear holocaust perpetrated by the Soviet Union, but that was okay because they were atheists and going to hell, and we were all Christians who were going to hell.
So really, jokes on you, commies. Yeah.
Yeah. So there were all kinds of like weird pressures and stuff like that going on at the time that I can analyze because I sort of lived through them, right? The whole sort of goth move, before it was really clearly articulated, and you have to remember that I grew up in the middle of nowhere in Virginia.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, my sister is 5 years older than me, and when she got her license, she would just kind of as a kick take me along with her on whatever like weird stuff, and she was getting to know all the art kids in high school, and they were kind of like the weirdos and the outsiders before that had sort of like reified into an image.
Yeah, yeah.
And somebody had slipped her the idea of Burton's A Nightmare Before Christmas, and she took me to see it like when it came out. And for this kid who was, you know, I guess I must have been in like sixth or seventh grade, it clicked in this way. This was the easy antithesis of everything that the culture was mostly promoting.
Yeah.
You know? It hit home for a sixth or seventh grader. Now I can see it as the easy antithesis of whatever the culture was promoting, and this kind of commodification and commercialization of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
But I guess you're right. I should have recalled the... there was a time before I had all this, you know, the weight of context behind me, and I could see things as art itself presented to me rather than as, you know, anyway, that's a whole other conversation.
Nightmare Before Christmas is one of the most conservative movies out there because what does it actually say? It undoes all of the revolutionary aspects of the counterculture by emphasizing, okay, stay in your lane.
Right. Everyone go back
Don't
into your
try
boxes.
To mix with everyone.
Right.
Yeah. At the same time, you have this weird kind of 90s... All right, you get that 90s exploration of sexuality with Dracula reinterpreted, the Bram Stoker's Dracula, runs absolutely on a Foucauldian trip. Like, it is... Bram Stoker, either he or his screenwriter, reinterpreted Dracula along Foucauldian lines. I mean, yeah. Beat by beat.
Oh, you mean Coppola? And or a screenwriter.
Yeah.
Bram Stoker was long dead, of course.
I'm sorry, not Bram Stoker. Coppola. Duh. Yeah. Sorry, it's late at night. And that was anticipated by Anne Rice, who kind of sort of did it before Coppola did. You have this weird internalization. You have this moment, at least in America, you have this moment of, okay, no external threat, let's start looking inward. And you have something like The X-Files, which is about that inward turn. What is happening in our backyard?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's not always bad or scary. I mean, X-Files, I think at its best, had a kind of exploratory attitude towards
it. Had a, there are a lot of episodes that have a very affectionate attitude toward whatever monster is at work. Yeah.
Yeah,
and of course, and you don't watch a show like X-Files unless you feel a certain affection for the gray aliens or something, like, you know.
Yeah,
yeah,
and then you have something like the Blair Witch Project, which looks in the backyard. That's one of the things they keep saying in the film: "This is America. Nobody gets lost in America."
Yeah,
but it's all about being lost in America and what's back there. I mean, it's Hawthorne,
yeah,
to rights.
Yeah, yeah.
By the early aughts, you have the anti-authority aspects of Gothicism sort of rearing their heads. They've been corporatized and incorporated and co-opted, but it's that co-opted anti-authority.
Yeah.
So you have the rise in ghost hunter shit.
Right, right.
And this kind of belief in demon possession and exorcism, the exorcism of Emily Rose. You know, the Exorcist was that horror movie which was basically anti-empirical from the get-go.
Right.
Like, which is all about how the sciences cannot handle this ancient evil. It's kind of like Dracula all over again. Exorcism of Emily Rose and, is that point of contact that just reinstates that.
Yeah. Real quick fun aside about The Exorcist. The name that the author of the novel selected to be like the ancient evil demon or whatever, Pazuzu, I learned recently was in the Akkadian, in the Mesopotamian and Assyrian tradition, was a guardian spirit to protect mothers in childbirth. It was actually wow, a very that. Good spirit that you wanted in your house when things were going down. Anyway, just like a fun aside.
Corporatist, authoritarian, misogynist tropes?
Who knows? Or maybe just, you know, pulling some sufficiently Semitic-sounding weird name out of a hat, you know?
Right. Well, so in the early aughts, you have that sort of anti-authoritarian, but totally authoritarian anti-authoritarian.
Oh, yeah.
In the late aughts, you basically have the domesticated gothic. You have things like True Blood, Twilight, and 50 Shades of Grey, which I want to argue are all about a money fantasy.
Yeah.
It's a fetishization about endless wealth and power. I mean, that's sort of like what happens in all of those things. You know, I hate to say it, but I could see the rise of Trump coming from a mile away with the rise of 50 Shades of Grey, which is not about a kink at all. 50 Shades of Grey and Twilight, because, you know, they're kind of the same thing.
Right, right. The 50 Shades of Grey is literally a fan fiction of Twilight with control F to change the names.
Yeah. But it's all money fantasy.
Yeah.
It's all money and power. But what you start seeing now, or more recently, I think, and one more time, this is skimming the surface, and this is us riffing at the end to try to bring it to a close. I'm talking broadly about horror and the gothic. What you've been seeing in the past, like, 5-10 years or so is the gothic or the horror as a place to explore trauma. Either personal trauma, interpersonal trauma, political trauma, social trauma, or however you want to define it. I'm thinking of Hereditary, The Witch, and Babadook.
Or Get Out.
Get Out is another great one. It Follows. So much horror and gothic material now. It's using those trappings to really sort of explore trauma, what it means to be in pain, what it means to hurt, what it means to fight back under those circumstances. The Witch is one of those things which I think is absolutely a feminist film about, I think that is the antithesis to something like The Craft or Nightmare Before Christmas, where it's not about staying in your lane. It's not about the reification of the old tropes. It's about, tear the patriarchal order down and just burn it.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing how it does that. But anyway, that sort of brings it, I guess, away from the history of the gothic per se and into this kind of cultural production of horror in a very sort of facile, brief skimming the surface way. And I want to make sure everybody knows that I'm not this dumb. I'm not usually this facile. But those are some ways that you can begin to think about conceptualizing the gothic in the 21st century.
Yeah, and I think as always, something I've always cautioned everyone whoever listens to any podcast whatsoever, and especially anyone that I have anything to do with, because I am definitely half-assed. If any of this sounds interesting, please understand that you are getting like a scintilla of the actual interesting content to be had out of something. So if any of this sounds interesting or something you want to dig into, I urge you to please go dig into it to actually find out cool stuff about it.
Yeah. So that's our, I mean, I feel like this isn't even 101. This is like 099 remedial session.
That's right.
These are some, I suppose, touchstones that you can hit on historically to begin to see the present in the past or the past in the present.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's what's sort of useful about thinking about the Gothic historically, is so much of this stuff is still with us, and it's got roots really far down there. It's not just whatever dark distortion pedal band that you're listening to at the moment. It goes back a long ways, and in a lot of ways it's been replicating itself with very little variation for about 200 years now,
which is fascinating to think the durability of so many of the kind of the hallmarks and tropes. It has to be speaking to something enduring, I guess, at least something enduring in industrialized society, you know, where this,
yeah.
And I guess science fiction is kind of a similar, you know, all these, you know, horror, you know, all these sort of kissing cousins genres. I'm developing in my mind I'm sure actual literary critics have developed this, and I'll have to look into it, but like the fact that this all came around during the inception of the kind of mass industrialized society that Great Britain and Western Europe then exported to the rest of the world, that has to mean something. But I guess at the end of the day, though, Claude, thank you for answering my question about how how this term came around. If you did, and you know what? What's even better than answering a question is raising 1,000 more, and that's something that we are both very good at. And I guess we can wrap it up for now. But thanks for a wonderful agoraphobia take on the Gothic, a survey of the Gothic, where it comes from, where it's going. And I don't know, I'm gonna go search for some cool goth rock live video from the 80s, man.
All right, man. If I can just put in one thing.
Yeah.
A great overlooked just art punk expressionist creepy band from New York in the early 80s, Live Skull.
Live Skull.
The name says it all. Yeah.
All right. Sweet.
Somewhere between Joy Division and early Sonic Youth. If you're looking for Gothic, I think that's up your alley.
Good God, dude! I am 1,000% there. That is incredible. All right, man. Well. All right.
And on that note, Agoraphobia out.
Agoraphobia out. Please listen to The Cannonball if you've enjoyed this episode of Agoraphobia. I am Daniel, and with me, as always, has been Claude, and we'll catch you guys later.
All right, take care.
A warm welcome back to those of you who made it back, and a little bit of advice to take with you before you go. Not all knowledge is safe, and some things you can't unhear. The smartest of you will count your blessings and stay clear of dark corners and dangerous downloads. But those of you more daring who laugh in the face of fear will undoubtedly be back, like a moth drawn to the flame, for the next installment of Agoraphobia.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The secret to summer-ready skin is here. Osea's number one best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil, clinically proven to instantly improve skin elasticity and transform dry skin to silky, soft, and unbelievably glowing. Its signature scent of freshly squeezed grapefruit, cypress, and mango mandarin transports you to sun-kissed summer days. Get healthy, glowing skin for summer with clean, vegan skincare from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com.